Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Parents are checking their emails, scouring their back-to-school handbooks, and considering whether or not masks are part of this year's back-to-school must-have clothing items. Some parents are trying to decide whether to send their children back into the classroom at all. It's time to take a deep breath and remember that everyone here wants the same thing out of back-to-school, basically. Safe and healthy kids, safe and healthy teachers and staff, safe and healthy families at home. We just don't necessarily agree on how to make all that happen or even how much actually hangs in the balance. Today we welcome Sanford Health's Dr. Wendell Hoffman back to the program. We're going to talk about the emerging research about kids and teenagers and SARS-CoV-2 transmission. What does a safer classroom look like? In the absence of a statewide mandate for school openings or classroom mitigation efforts, how can parents and teachers evaluate the science we currently have so they can make smart decisions about how to live out personal responsibility during the pandemic? This is all part of our weekly updates on COVID-19, so we'll have some general information for the rest of you who don't have kids in school as well. Dr. Wendell Hoffman, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Lori. Good to be with you.
Many parents are, almost on the verge of panic because the back-to-school date is coming quickly. And so I just want to turn it over to you for a minute and ask the first question, which is, you know, what kind of science is emerging about kids and teenagers and SARS-CoV transmission? Like, what do we know at this point? What do we not know?
Great question. We probably could use a couple of hours to roll through this, but yeah. What do we know? So what we know, and this was early on in the pandemic data coming out of China, is that we knew early on from their experience that this virus was very mild in terms of its effect on children. That data continued to be the case going forward as we have been engulfed in our own pandemic here in the U.S., So kids and youth count for, in multiple studies, maybe 5 to 10% of the overall SARS-CoV-2 symptomatic infections. In South Dakota, I believe I calculated that about 12% of the total number of positive cases, remember these are positive cases, so they do not count asymptomatic cases, and if it is true that the total number of infections may be, 8 to 10 times the number of positives, then of course we have many more that we don't even know about. But the point being is that the children and youth count for a small percentage overall. There is some data, particularly now with the now famous South Korea study, to suggest that children, particularly those under 10, may be less susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 infection and potentially less likely to transmit the virus to others. Also, there's, I think, strong evidence, and I always have to qualify this because I do depend heavily on my pediatric colleagues, and I don't pretend to be a pediatrician, nor have I ever played one on TV, but I have seen a lot of kids in my career, and I do have great admiration and also for the guidance that my pediatric infectious disease colleagues have struggled with, and pediatricians in general have struggled with, trying to put together these recommendations. That said, there's strong evidence that the majority of children and youth who become infected are either asymptomatic or only have mild symptoms such as cough, fever, and sore throat. So I think we have to put all of this into that background context. And to say, for instance, of the 1,136 hospitalizations in the 0 to 19 category in South Dakota, I believe there have only been 25 hospitalizations. That's a 2.2% hospitalization rate. It's very small. We have zero deaths in that group. And so I think the emerging science says that the young children may be a little bit different as you get older. Now, as you turn age 10 and you move up into middle school and high school, you begin to look more like the adult patient in terms of the ability to transmit it to each other and to others, say, in the family. So I think that's an accurate summary of the emerging science as we have it with regards to transmission and seriousness of disease.
Can you speak a little more to whether or not kids can bring the virus home to their families if they're asymptomatic or if they're mildly symptomatic? What do we know about how likely they are to transmit it to adults?
So, yes, I mean, I think we can say that, and remember, we stopped the school closures kind of right earlier on in the pandemic in the United States. So there's a lot we have to learn. However, the data worldwide suggests that kids are probably more likely to get it within their households than they are in non-households. But we really don't know because we've not entered our own experiment, if you will, in this country. We are comparing ourselves to other countries, and while that's very, very good, I think we have to say that we can expect that there will be more infections as the schools open up. I mean, all you need to do is look at the kids out in the at the camp in the Black Hills. When you get kids together, there's going to be transmission. That's why all these mitigating strategies are so important. So I think we have to be honest and say we can expect probably that we may well have more cases. Now, the average age of a teacher in South Dakota, I actually looked this up, was about, I think it was 42.7, 43-ish. Now, so if the average age is in that range, we have to say that the vast majority of teachers, for instance, and probably parents, are going to be in that age group where they're, if they do come down with COVID-19, they also are going to experience a relatively mild condition. So I think the overall risk, we may have a lot of cases, but I think we need to focus on the sort of seriousness and therefore, hopefully, respect the virus but not fear it.
Yeah. You mentioned the camp in Keystone, and would you explain for listeners, you know, the difference between as we evaluate, you know, a news headline or a study, the difference between a case study where we can look at a choir in Washington or a camp somewhere versus, you know, the gold standard of research? How do we, as parents, kind of scrolling through the news, remember what we're looking at when we look at a case study versus something that is more rigorously, and you might even want to touch a little bit on, you know, the ethic. We can't infect a bunch of, you know, kids with SARS-CoV-2 and then study, you know, what happens. There's limitations to the kind of science that we can get out of this as we're going through it.
So yes, I mean, really any observational study, like let's take the camp out in the Black Hills, that where you're going to have the Department of Health looking at the occurrence of cases and doing contact tracing and then reporting out what they see. That, in a sense, would be a case study. So really a case study is any formal look at any kind of an outbreak. And we use observational studies all the time. They're very, very important. You're right. I mean, it is a different kind of science, if you will, but it's very important, and it's what epidemiology is really all about.
Yeah. Let's talk about mitigation strategies. You said they're so important. So for many parents, if they decide, you know, we don't have someone at home, for example, with who's highly at risk. So we're going to make a choice to send our kid to school and not do things remotely for a variety of reasons. What does a safer experience look like? What are the mitigation strategies that really matter in a classroom environment?
So here's where there's a kind of an old saying that says, "What we desperately want is knowledge, but what we desperately need is wisdom." And so we have a relatively, we have limited knowledge in this country regarding kids and schools opening up. What we need is a lot of wisdom, therefore, based upon limited knowledge. But that's been true of this pandemic overall. And so I would refer your listeners to a number of good documents that are out there for guidance for school reopening. The American Academy of Pediatrics, for instance. Particularly, I thought a good one was the Sick Kids guidance for school reopening coming out of Ontario, which is a marvelous document, I think, that really summarizes a lot of this stuff within these different categories. So, what was the question again?
Trying to think about what are the strategies, the mitigating strategies that matter.
Apologize.
Yeah, what works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think we have to go back to the blocking and tackling that we've talked about before. I think the social distancing, which will be challenging in schools, the use of masks, which I think is there's a lot of very solid evidence. Not direct evidence, but what we would call indirect evidence. So you're not going to put 50 people in a room with masks and 50 people in a room without masks and expose them all to SARS-CoV-2 and then say, okay, masks work or they don't. But if that's the kind of proof you're looking for, then we can never say that wearing seatbelts and using airbags has ever been proven. We're not going to do that. It's all based upon, for instance, indirect evidence, and there's lots of it out there. The prior use of masks in healthcare in general, the nature of this virus, which is quite contagious, and which any cloth material is going to help some in containing those respiratory secretions. Number three are the studies that show different kinds of masks preventing transmission outward of of these respiratory secretions, and then lastly, to get back to it, the observational studies that show that masks do decrease the incidence of this infection within healthcare organizations, which I think is the main proof that masks work, is within healthcare systems themselves. The last two would be hand hygiene, very important, particularly and probably with the younger children. Because they're always going to their nose, it's going to be tough for them to wear masks. They're touching each other and they're touching everything, and so hand hygiene will be particularly important. And then lastly, the environmental cleaning. Although to be honest, I think the whole issue of fomite transmission, so virus laying on a hard surface that you then pick up secondarily, is probably, well, I think it definitely is less important than the direct transmission between one person and another, primarily large droplet, primarily over a 3 to 6 foot distance. So I think those are the principles. The school systems, I think, in their great wisdom, knowing children and their behavior, are going to apply these things in a very wise manner, and they're going to dive in because we know that, and the pediatricians are speaking loudly on this, that the adverse impacts of school closure on children and youth, and I'm quoting here from that Sick Kids document, significantly outweigh the current benefit of keeping schools closed in order to reduce the risk of COVID-19 in children, youth, school staff, and the community at large. So I think the pediatricians are really speaking, PEDS-ID and general pediatrics are speaking with one voice, that the harm here, what we could call the incalculable collateral damage, is very significant, and it's one of my personal frustrations with how a lot of the COVID-19 stuff has been sort of promoted, is that we're talking about harm only related to the virus. We're not talking enough about the harm of what we've had to do in closing everything down. And so I think a little lesson from the medical side is we commonly say, quoting the famous Hippocrates, as to diseases, make a habit of two things, to help or at least to do no harm. Well, in this case, you've got both short-term and long-term harm. And I find it interesting that the segment of the population that appears to handle this the best may be the very segment that is going to experience significant harm in the long term. So I think we have to make this calculation. I'm fully in support of schools opening up, using these wisdom principles and relying on the great wisdom of our teachers, our administrators, our school staff to allow kids not to experience the long-term harm that everybody is afraid of.
Yeah. One last question, and it's about masks. If you live in a district and you're sending your child into a classroom where masks are optional, the teachers have done their best to either provide, you know, some kind of plexiglass barrier from desks or to separate those desks, but yet there's, you know, going to the bathroom and going to the lunchroom and things in the hallway. If it's a choice and you know that some of those kids are not going to wear their masks because they're choosing not to, do you send your kid to school in a mask? Does it really protect them? Does it just protect the other kids? Like, how would you make that how would you advise a parent to make that decision if it's up to each family?
Well, of course, I'm a believer in the use of masks, but I think we have to be honest that masks, I think primarily have to do with source control. That means that the reason I wear a mask is to try to prevent you from getting infection from me, as opposed to personal protective equipment, the famous PPE, where I'm trying to protect myself. The higher quality of the mask, the closer you're going to get to a PPE effect. The lower the quality of mask, you're going to be more into the source control effect. So my advice would be that I would advise masks whenever possible. They're going to be more important in the older age child and in the adolescents, I think, because again, with the current data, with the current evidence, it suggests that younger children may not transmit this as readily. Also, it's just going to be very difficult for those younger school-age kids to wear masks, although kids are very resilient, and we may be really surprised at how willing they are to wear face coverings as a way to prevent transmission. So my advice would be, unless there's contraindications, unless it's been with the discussion with their primary physician to say that, this is probably not going to work with this particular child for a variety of reasons, underlying medical conditions and so forth and so on, they should try to wear a mask and go with your local school rollout plan. And remember that this is just the beginning. We're just coming out of the gate here, and there will be lots of things that will be tweaked and changed. We'll learn a lot. We'll change on the go. What we start with, just like with the SARS pandemic overall, is not where we're going to end up. This is a completely different situation than it was 2 months ago because of what we've learned. And we haven't even talked about testing within schools and what that's going to do and how that's going to help us. So I'm very hopeful. I'm very optimistic that we can keep kids, their parents, teachers, you know, as safe as possible, while also avoiding that long-term harm problem, which I think everybody probably agrees with. If learning is at least 50% social, and I'm not quoting a study there, but I think healthcare, for instance, is at least 50% social science and 50% hard science. If learning is somewhat like that, then we have to get kids back together. But we have to do it in a responsible way and use these mitigating strategies that can be applied in many different ways. And we will learn from each other. One school district may learn from another school district. I think it's going to be a massive learning exercise. I'm actually quite optimistic and excited to see how we're going to live alongside this virus because we have to. We can't go back.
Dr. Wendell Hoffman, thank you for the knowledge and the wisdom today. We really appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you next time.
Thanks, Laurie.